From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in late June when the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. Since then, political leaders across the country and at the state level, at the federal level, they've been speaking out. That includes Congressman Joe Morelli. He issued this statement about it. He said, quote, "This is a tragic day in America. The Supreme Court has just delivered the most disastrous and terrifying ruling in decades. This formally begins an all-out assault on women's rights. Today's decision has reversed over 50 years of progress and will return our nation to a dark and dangerous era where women no longer have control over their own bodies. At this very moment, states around the nation are moving to criminalize a woman's right to make her own health care decisions and her fundamental right to privacy. We must turn our anger into action. I remain steadfast in my commitment to protecting women's health care, and I will work tirelessly to protect the essential rights and freedoms that all women deserve." End quote. We're going to talk about that, what that means at the federal level. We're also going to talk about a wide range of other issues with Congressman Morelli. Of course, the recent bill that addresses climate in what is possibly a historic way, but the recent bill that has also been criticized by Republicans for on a number of different levels for some of the spending involved, some of the expansion of the IRS, and a lot more. And we're going to cover it, and then some, with Congressman Morelli, who's with us. Congressman, thank you for making the time, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Evan. It's good to be with you. I feel like we haven't chatted in a while. I know every time it seems like we've been ready to do it, something has happened in Washington, but it's great to be with you.
Well, there's nothing going on, right? Nothing that would make you busy. I mean, it's... You know, what a time. So there's a lot to cover here. And I want to also be clear to listeners that given the sort of endless nature of campaigns and the fact that we are now 3 months away roughly from another election, that all candidates for office are invited on. We have not been able to convince Lauren Singletary, the Republican running for the same seat here, to join us. But that invitation is open and it will continue to be so. But this is about sort of the business of Washington right now. And I'll start on Roe, but there's a lot of places I want to go here. Just I know it was not necessarily a surprise when that Supreme Court decision comes. And I also know that, you know, you worked in Albany, Congressman Morelli, when the sort of the codification of Roe was happening and some of the fortification of those healthcare rights were happening. So how high of a priority is it for you, given that you're not representing a southern state, you're not representing Missouri, you are representing New York? What do you want to see happen at the federal level?
Well, it's really a great point because, Evan, in a lot of conversation I've had with colleagues in Washington, but also my colleagues in the state legislature as well, you know, we do have great rights in New York. Women have the right to choose. Women have the right to make their own reproductive rights decisions. But the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution essentially says that if Congress passed a law banning abortions, they will be banned everywhere. So a national ban is very real. It's a real threat to people everywhere. So we can't be complacent because those New York rights that we keep talking about are only will only survive as long as Congress doesn't work to enact a national ban. But that's already being talked about. I mean, there are extremists in Washington, and more are among the Republican caucus. And so there's going to be the introduction of a national ban. So this is why this election is so important. And that's why I keep talking about it, because these are fundamental issues. I mean, you know, people have read certainly Justice Alito's decision on Dobbs, which overturned Roe, but many, probably an equal number, have read the concurring opinion by Justice Thomas and the question of privacy in our lives and whether that's guaranteed under the Constitution is as much in jeopardy as the obviously critically important but more narrow question of reproductive health.
Right. And so that could extend to equal marriage, for example. Where are you on that question in terms of what federal mechanism there is to ensure equal marriage?
So we passed a bill in the House just a few weeks ago, which would make it federal law that the states could not in any way harm same-sex marriages. I was in Albany when we passed that protection in New York. So this is really a critical issue because, given what Justice Thomas said, people are rightly concerned. I mean, this goes to families. I mean, the ability to potentially dissolve families as people who are in the LGBTQ community rightly beyond concerned about what happened. So we passed this bill in the House, and frankly, it generated, I think, more Republican votes than anyone expected. People were, I think, surprised at the dozens of Republicans who crossed over and supported the bill. That, I think, gave some sense of optimism. I know Senator Baldwin is carrying the bill in the Senate. There was a great New York Times piece, I think, this weekend, sort of detailing and highlighting her efforts. So there is some optimism it could pass the United States Senate. Clearly, the president will sign the bill. But again, another issue that is very much up for debate now that Clarence Thomas has opened the door. He also opened the door to the question of contraception. And I said in the Rules Committee debate on these subjects, I can't imagine a more intimate and personal decision than reproductive rights. And the notion that somehow the United States government would step in, or frankly even allow the state governments to step in on such incredibly personal, incredibly intimate decisions for families is almost inconceivable to me. So I think this is one of the real distinctions that will be made during the midterm elections.
Congressman, did the Kansas vote change the framework of what is possible at all, whether that's legislatively or otherwise? And I say that because, you know, everybody knows now Kansas overwhelmingly voted to essentially protect abortion rights, to block a scenario where the state could ban it. And most of the polling before that vote was that it was a coin flip, that it was not going to be a blowout, and it turned out to be a blowout. What does that inform in Washington, if anything, when it comes to legislation, other considerations?
Yeah, it's really an interesting question because I think, as often is the case, sometimes conventional wisdom tends to be a little off. I think some people are hailing it as a partisan victory. I actually think what it says is in, you know, pretty conservative, safe Kansas, red Kansas, the fact that you'd win that question for choice advocates by nearly 20% tells me there are a lot of Republicans and non-affiliated voters who care deeply about this issue. You know, whether that translates and how that, you know, whether it translates into victories at the polls, you know, who knows? I mean, we'll find out. But it tells me that there are a lot of people within the Republican Party who quietly, maybe they're not saying anything publicly for fear of being ostracized by the party. But that tells me there are a lot of folks who are rightly concerned about the overreach of this decision and the overreach of people within the extreme wing of the Republican Party who want to continue to control women's bodies and perhaps much more broadly when it comes to privacy rights.
Talking to Congressman Joe Morelli, later this hour we'll take some of your feedback, questions, comments, if you have them, for the congressman. So let's hit a couple of other points that are currently, you know, sort of right there in front of you, I would say. And one of them is the fact that a month ago, if I would have talked to climate activists, scientists, climate scientists, there was a despair that Washington was going to be able to get anything done in the way of climate. And I was actually having dinner with someone who's worked in this sphere for 20 years this weekend when she got a text and basically learned that it was going to happen. And it was an emotional moment. It was, it wasn't a let's focus on what we didn't like or what do we have to give Senator Manchin to get this across the line or what do we have to give Senator Sinema to get across the line. It was a focus on the net of the bill for climate. And it was a feeling of both relief and I think a renewed optimism that something could actually get done here. But it's not over yet. It's not past every finish line it needs to get to. So why don't you update people on where we're going next with it?
Yeah, so the bill which you're referring to, the Inflation Reduction Act, has passed the United States Senate, incredibly under the reconciliation process, which I'm sure a lot of listeners by now know avoids the question of having to get a cloture vote passed with 60 votes. So they did it with 51 votes. huge, huge victory. And I'm going to be leaving as soon as I get off with you, Evan. I'm going to join the Rules Committee, and we're going to put that bill on the floor for Friday morning. So it will have to have final passage and, of course, go to the president who is going to sign it. But I think you're right that I think climate advocates, and frankly, if we're not all climate advocates at this point, I don't know what we're reading or what we're watching or what we believe, but I don't think you have to go much further than literally Europe being on fire this summer and half of the United States. And you continue to see the manifestation of the climate crisis in our daily lives. So, you know, this is huge, $360 billion over the next 10 years, in addition to what we did in the infrastructure bill and what we continue to do. This is, and I think you're right, people were now, perhaps many people had lost faith, thinking this simply isn't going to happen. That kind of like Lucy with the football and Charlie Brown, that every time you get close, the football gets yanked and you don't get an opportunity to do something. And, you know, credit Chuck Schumer, who's been a longtime friend and a partner for us in this region, a friend of mine personally. I mean, I think he's done a great job. And, you know, I'm sure it's not popular with a lot of people, but Senator Manchin at least came back to the table. And, you know, is it perfect? I've never voted for a perfect piece of legislation in my years in government. So, no, it's not perfect. It is the nature of compromise. But this is a huge step forward. And I don't think you can underestimate for a moment the enormous impact this will have. And I think it says volumes not only to the American public, but it's going to send a strong message to world leaders. The United States is finally fully engaged in the question of how do we save the planet.
When does it actually get voted on in the House? You said you're going to bring it Friday. When's the actual vote likely to be?
I expect I won't get into all the really details. There'll be a series of votes, but I expect we'll start voting around 9:30 or 10 Friday morning. That's to pass the rule, and then we'll have the final votes. I would guess probably early afternoon. The great thing about this is, you know, the Rules Committee has to consider which amendments will be made in order and which, you know, things will be considered for votes. But because this came from the Senate, and any change at all would render it inoperative, we'll keep exactly with the Senate text. So it's going to be a much less of a lengthy debate, I hope. And Friday, when people are in drive time going home, this will have passed both houses and on its way to the president.
Let me read some of the criticism of this bill that comes from the person who's running against you. This is straight from the Twitter feed of Laron Singletary. He says, no matter what you name a bill, Inflation Reduction Act or whatever, elections have consequences and Americans will not be fooled. My advice to small business owners, bolt your doors, change your locks, because 87,000 IRS agents are coming for you. Senate Democrats put $80 billion into the spend and tax bill to hire 87,000 IRS agents, not to get you a quicker refund, but to monitor your accounts and to increase the audits. Any member in the U.S. House of Representatives who votes for the so-called Inflation Reduction Act is voting for 87,000 new IRS agents to take more money from the middle class, end quote. What do you say to that?
Well, I say a couple things. I you know, have now watched for 10 months Laron Singletary tweet out every day his criticism of everything that's happening in Washington and everything that happens in Rochester. I haven't heard a single solitary idea from him on what he would do to make anything better. But let's take the bill in question tomorrow. It's going to be historic in many ways. We've talked about the historic investment in clean energy and reducing the impact of the climate crisis. It's going to, for the first time in 57 years, the entire history of Medicare, and allow the U.S. government and the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate lower prescription drug prices for senior citizens. Millions and millions and millions of Americans are going to be affected in a positive way. It caps out-of-pocket expenses. It's going to bring down the cost of insulin to $35 a month, which is a life-sustaining drug, a life-saving drug for millions of Americans. It is going to require corporations of $1 billion in revenue or more to pay a minimum income tax of 15%, which is high time we did that. That raises billions and billions of dollars that will help not only pay for this, but will end up giving us a deficit reduction over the next 10 years of somewhere between $200 and $300 billion, and that's we're still waiting for final numbers on that. And then, you know, the other thing it's going to do is it's going to extend subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, so people can continue to have health care coverage. As it relates to the IRS, look, the IRS is so short-staffed, they can't produce and return refunds. They can't do their work. And I find it curious someone would continue to decry the fact that the government would actually have enough people to process tax returns. So, you know, will it result in audits of billionaires? I think probably, yes. Frankly, the IRS has already said that it will not increase audits of middle class or low income Americans. So that's not true. It's fundamentally misleading, everything that has been said in the statement. And a number of economists have said it will have the impact of having a downward pressure on inflationary pressures. So, look, 2 out of 3 Americans, from what I see in the early polling, are very supportive of this bill. And is it perfect? Of course not. Nothing is perfect. There are some trade-offs here that I think some people would have preferred not to make. But on the whole, it's hard to argue that this isn't one of the most significant piece of legislation that's going to pass the Congress in the last couple of decades, particularly around lower drug costs and dealing with the climate crisis.
One other point that your opponent in the race has hit on with some frequency is gun violence, safety, and rhetoric about policing. And as you, of course, know, this community dealt recently with the shooting death of Rochester officer Anthony Mazurkiewicz. His eldest son, Bradley Jamison, directed a message at politicians at all levels calling for change so his father did not die in vain. He said at the funeral and at the service, quote, "I'd like to finish this with a challenge to our elected officials to allow Tony's death and all the grieving in this room to be the catalyst to make changes and apply the necessary resources to ensure this doesn't happen again and to make for damn sure something good comes from this," end quote. I'm curious to know what you make of some of that, what kind of change you think your interpretation is that they're looking for, and what mechanisms there are, if any, sort of from the federal level, because I know a lot of the debate has been about state law in this regard. But what do you make of all of that, and what do you make of the criticism from your opponent that, that he feels that Democrats have not been focused enough on public safety?
Well, look, I was at the funeral. I had a chance to go to the wake and pay my respects to the family, and it's hard not to be moved to have been at the service, to hear from family members about Officer Mazurkiewicz and all the contributions he made. And I think, Brad was right in his comments that we need to do more, that something positive needs to come out of this. So, look, I don't think anyone isn't supportive of law enforcement. You know, when I talk to people in the most affected communities, they'll say, continue to provide support for our neighborhoods, continue to have law enforcement, don't defund the police. But by the same token, they want reforms in policing and reforms in other ways. So a couple of things that I would just describe immediately. First is, I've been working with the U.S. Attorney General. I've been working with the Department of Justice, the U.S. prosecutors, and the U.S. Attorney local here on federal prosecutions. Gun violence, we should have zero tolerance for. And it is completely, completely inexcusable. There are no excuses. There's no reason for anyone to suggest that gun violence doesn't deserve the highest degree of work on our part to make sure we get guns off the street and the people who perpetrate this violence get them off the street, which is why I'm pushing for more federal prosecutions, because you can consider how dangerous the person who's detained is and what their risk of flight is when it's a federal prosecution. So I'm going to continue to push for it, and I'm going to continue to talk to my partners in government about that. The second thing we have to do, and this is where I think, LaRon Singletary and I differ so dramatically, and I find it rather astonishing, former police officer who thinks that we don't need to do anything to crack down illegal gun trafficking, that we don't need to ban assault weapons, that we don't need universal background checks, that we don't need extreme protection orders. All of those things would save lives. There are thousands and thousands of illegal guns on the streets in our community alone, millions of guns on our streets across the country. There are 400 million guns in America, and we have 340, 350 million people. We have more guns than people. We'll have nearly 50,000 deaths by gun violence this year alone, and the numbers keep growing. So I just find it unimaginable, particularly since law enforcement are often the targets, how someone who served in law enforcement takes a position that you can't change anything about gun laws. On his website, it says something like, and I might be paraphrasing that, any infringement is infringement, referring to the Second Amendment. So we dramatically differ on that. And here's the final thing, Evan, which is if our only answer is going to be just putting people in jail, then you're going to wait for the crimes to be committed and you're going to put them in jail. And what do we gain on that? We've seen how this movie ends, which is just more and more people being incarcerated. No talk about investment in child tax credits. No talk about further investments in Head Start or expanding child nutrition. I mean, the young people, and it's increasingly young people who are involved in these altercations, they've lost hope. They've turned to either being a part of a group or a gang because they feel some kind of inclusion. You know, I don't know the answer. I think there's impacts of mental health. There's clearly a whole host of things. But to not make any investments in people, not to give people opportunity to the workplace, not to be able to gainfully employ people, if you don't have any desire or any inclination to invest in those things, then what is it we're going to do? So I'll wait. I've been waiting for 10 months for Lauren Singletary to even talk about one single solitary proposal on any of the great issues facing the country. And I keep asking and I keep hearing what they call deafening silence.
Well, again, Lauren Singletary is invited to this program and we hope to have him soon. Just one more point on this. I want to make sure I understand where you are on something. You mentioned assault rifles. Now, we recently had Assemblymember Stephen Hawley on this program who told me that it might have been a mistake when he voted against bump stocks. And that, because I said, look, you keep using the word infringement, but you're not in favor of fully automatic weapons. You're not in favor of bump stocks, which effectively make guns fully automatic weapons. And he said, well, maybe that was a mistake I had. Maybe I should have. He essentially opened the door to saying there should be no infringements. We should have open carry, and even if it's full automatic. That is not a world that most Americans want. That is drastically out of step with the vast majority of Americans, but it is a position that is at least consistent intellectually. If you're against infringement, you think it's infringement, fine. Now, I understand that's not where you are, Congressman, but I do want to hit one point. You mentioned assault rifles. Every time I say the word assault weapon or assault rifle, I get an email from someone who says, well, they're technically sporting rifles and you're using a term of propaganda. And I will say that everything is in this realm feels like propaganda. Sporting rifles feels like, you know, it's like a gentle term, like we're just sporting, you know, when that is not the mission of what they were created for. But OK, sporting rifles. Are you in favor of a full ban? And I mean a ban of future sales or a ban and confiscation of existing?
Well, look, I am for a ban of certain types of weapons that are, you know, military style assault weapons. But this is why. And by the way, I think most Americans are as well. And I don't think it's a small majority. I think it's a large majority. But here's what I would say, Evan. I would be happy to engage people on the other side of the aisle who I consider very extreme on this. If you want to have a conversation about which models of weapons are included, which are not, if you want to describe how you see this, we could have a conversation. We should have a conversation, though, not in isolation. What about universal background checks? What about extreme orders of protection? I was out knocking on doors about a week and a half ago. So I go to this house, and this young man comes out. He says, I have an issue I want to talk to you about. I said, okay. He said, I'm a former U.S. Army military police officer, and I'm a U.S. Army reservist. And he points to his car and he said, in order for me to drive that, I have to have a driver's license, meaning demonstrating competency. I have to register this vehicle. I have to have it inspected so I know it works well. And I have to have insurance for it. I said, yeah. He said, why don't we do the same thing for guns? And he said, and by the way, I'm a Republican. Why can't we get this done? I said, honestly, first of all, I congratulated him for being a thoughtful Republican on the issue and someone who's obviously handled weapons. I think that's how most Americans agree. Like, what are we talking about here? I mean, all the things for motor vehicles, which actually provide transportation, yes, they can be deadly, but they actually have a use other than being lethal weapons. So, you know, this is what I find about sort of the extreme right on these issues. They want to nitpick about specific weapons and specific, you know, high capacity magazines. Okay, let's have a real conversation, but let's have a good faith effort. And by the way, one of the most conservative Supreme Court justices, certainly in the modern era, was Antonin Scalia, who said clearly that the state does have, and by state, he means state, federal government, he means government at large, has every right to protect its citizens in reasonable ways, particularly when the rights of citizens are imposed upon by any amendment in the Constitution, any section of the Constitution. So, you know, we talk about the right to religion. Everyone has the right to follow whatever faith they want. But if your religion included live sacrifices on an altar somewhere, clearly the United States government would step in. So there, no right is an unconditional right. Every right is conditioned on its ability to be exercised without the imposition on other people's rights. The same is true, and Scalia said this very clearly, that we have the right to do it. So let's find the way to do it. Let's not say we can have no infringement on Second Amendment rights. It's absurd. And it's funny to me that people don't find it ironic that they're perfectly willing to have the government control reproductive rights of a woman, but somehow the government has no ability to have reasonable control over the use, purchase of lethal weapons.
Okay, before I move on, though, just briefly, that means yes to banning, also yes to confiscating existing assault weapons?
Well, look, would I do it? Yes. But I would say this as well. If you want to, you could also do this. You're a sports person. You want to fire your assault weapon at a shooting range. We can do it so that you go check your gun in. It stays stored at a firing range. You go, you check it out, you use it for purposes of target shooting, then you lock it back up when you leave. I think there are a lot of ways to get it. Getting into the specific points, again, I think if we were to negotiate a fair, reasonable, thoughtful way of doing it, we would like to raise the age of people can purchase these weapons to 21. I had a gentleman at an American Legion gathering, a veteran who came up to me and said, I don't think we should raise it to 21. I think we should raise it to 25. It's been fascinating over the last couple of months, particularly the people who have approached me about it. And sometimes we all get fooled by what we think someone is going to say and what they really say. But I think Americans are clamoring. I think they're sick and tired of turning on the television. It seems like every day, and either hearing about local shootings or hearing about mass shootings. I think Americans understand that we have to do something in this space.
All right, a couple other issues and questions from me, and then I'll turn it over to our listeners. Congress has been asked repeatedly to authorize various expenditures on funding weaponry for Ukraine. What's the horizon in your mind for how long this country can continue to fund that? Is there a limit to where you see wise levels of funding? Are there weapon systems that you think start to cross any lines? And are you an optimist with what you are seeing in turn? I don't want to mean to be sort of blithe about this. I mean, no one should be optimistic watching an invasion and what looks like an attempted genocide. I mean, it's horrible. But do you have a sense that some sort of victory can still be achieved for Ukraine?
Well, I think it's a really great question. I think we've all hoped that there would be a so-called off-ramp where Vladimir Putin would at least state whether it would be acceptable or not, state the beginning of a strategy to withdraw I don't see that. I'm not overly optimistic in that regard. But the United States will continue to do this. I serve on the Armed Services Committee. There is no end to what we will do. We'll continue to support Ukraine. We're not going to back away from that commitment. I think what you're going to see, and this could go on, Evan, could go on another 6 months, hopefully, you know, not, but it could go on much longer than that. But what you're clearly starting to see is real cracks in the not only the Russian military, but in Russia itself. They're increasingly pariahs in the world stage. Instead of, as Putin said, creating more of a buffer between Russia and NATO, he has managed to achieve the exact opposite. And I suspect Finland and Sweden are both going to very soon join NATO. And the world community is more turning away from him. I think you see economically they're struggling. They get very little access to chips and other devices necessary to control their machinery and keep machines going. The Ukrainian people have been extraordinary in their resiliency and their courage, and we're going to continue to support it. And, you know, I know there have been at the beginning, and there'll continue to be some folks within the Ukrainian community here in Rochester and elsewhere who would like the United States to be more aggressive. But as I often remind people, the Russian Federation has access to 7,000 nuclear warheads. The next nuclear war will not take 6 years. It'll take 6 hours, and it will leave hundreds of millions of humans dead. So we're trying to do everything we can to be supportive, to support them with lethal aid, to support them with humanitarian aid. I don't see an end to it, and I certainly don't see a weakening of the resolve of Congress in this regard. But you know, the end will be to some degree of Putin's choosing, but as long as he's conducting this war, we're gonna be there, and we're gonna support the Ukrainian people.
Do you have any concerns with the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago? Do you have any sense for what that warrant really was about?
You know, the Department of Justice and the FBI don't share with the public, and they certainly don't share with members of Congress the reasons that they search and seize evidence from people's homes. I know there's a lot of chatter about this, but fundamentally, there needs to be accountability of all elected officials. There needs to be accountability of all public officials. There needs to be accountability of all citizens. And I don't think anyone could watch with an open mind the January 6th hearings in the last couple of months and not come away with a deep-founded, deep-seated fear for what's going on in this country. And the notion that a sitting U.S. president would actively support what effectively was a coup and would support and not take any actions to stop the violence of the Capitol on January 6th, and instead was trying to set up fake electors to overturn the Electoral College. That is the most foundational and fundamental issue. So there needs to be accountability. I don't know what we would say otherwise. I gather the Department of Justice and the FBI have real concerns. They went to a judge, got a warrant to do it. To not do it would essentially be saying, well, you know, there's two kinds of justice. There's justice for most Americans, and then there's justice for a handful of Americans, and or we can't do it because too many people will be annoyed. I mean, the comments that have come out of, like, Kevin McCarthy, who wants to be Speaker of the House of Representatives, the comments that he has uttered in the last several days border on treasonous, in my view. If you're not going to support the Constitution of the United States, fundamentally, we have nothing. We really have nothing. It is the contract that binds us all together. It is the rule of law. And I you know, I can't say enough. You didn't ask about her, but Liz Cheney, in my mind, will go down. I said this to her recently. No matter what happens, and I know she's facing an almost impossible climb to reelection, but she will go down in history as one of the great American patriots. And I couldn't be more grateful to her for her service. But so, sorry, it's a long answer. But the short answer is I think it would be not doing your duty to the Constitution for the Justice Department and the FBI not to execute the search warrant. And I'm assuming they have very good reasons. And I'm assuming in time Americans will know what those reasons were and what evidence they were searching for, and we'll make judgments then. But I think it's highly irresponsible for members of Congress and other elected officials to attack the FBI and the Department of Justice without knowing anything about what they're looking for and why they're looking for it.
Talking to Congressman Joe Morelli. Let's get some feedback from listeners. This is Nick in Rochester. Hi, Nick. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for having me. Street homelessness has plagued Rochester and is on the rise. Rents are above affordability, and our organization, Person-Centered Housing Options, believes in your work, Congressman, but we can't build and develop housing first options to scale fast enough. What do you think the economic solution might be, and how can our government and community support housing first at the state and federal level to stop the rise of street homelessness and increase our affordability?
Thank you, Nick. Go ahead, Congressman.
Yeah, it's a great question, Nick, and thank you for everything you do. Affordability is a huge issue. We've been desperately trying to get additional dollars in the now defunct Build Back Better. There's $150 billion. Much of it would have come to New York for affordable housing. But there's a lot more to do in this space. And, you know, Rochester is blessed. We have some of the best affordable housing developers anywhere in the state, anywhere in the country, and some folks at HCR said that recently at events here in town. But it's got to, we've got to do much more than that. So we do have to address affordability. We have to increase the supply of affordable housing. We have to find federal and state dollars to do it. But we also have to connect people better to services. And we need in not only person-centered housing, we need a person-centered approach to social health and educational services, something I work a great deal on, connecting service providers, make more sense out of the dollars we spend, have much better outcomes. But we are getting to a crisis point in our state. And it also brings in the question of how we deal with opioids and how we deal with other mental health and behavioral health issues, because people traditionally and typically don't have an affordability issue only. There are a whole host of other issues that include whether they're prepared to join the workforce, whether or not they've got the right skills to continue to climb in a career, whether they have adequate food and nutrition, whether they have behavioral and mental health issues. So there are a whole host of issues, but we're going to continue to work, and I'm going to work with the mayor and the county executive and other partners to try to find the dollars necessary to increase affordability, but also to provide wraparound services so we can truly sort of get to the you know, the fundamental issues that that challenge families.
All right. Dallas writes to say there was an amendment that would have prevented the new 87,000 IRS agents from auditing people making less than $4,000 a year. Why did Joe Morelli vote against it?
Well, I have no idea what that is. I don't think we've done any.
You're saying that's not a real thing.
I don't believe it's real. I don't even if you, first of all, if you make less than $4,000 a year,
$400,000.
Well, the IRS has said they're not auditing. And look, by the way, if you make $250,000 a year and you're cheating on your taxes, why shouldn't you be audited? I mean, anybody who's cheating on their taxes, but the IRS has clearly said that the audit functions, if they increase them, will be on high income Americans. They have really been starved. I mean, if we want a fair tax system, you could argue about the level of taxation. You could argue about 2017 tax reform, which generated 83% of its benefits to the top 1% of Americans. You could have that debate. But why are we afraid of people whose job it is simply to transact the business of collecting and remitting taxes back out? It's so inappropriate. And this is where the extreme right just can't help themselves. They really want to eliminate government. They want to really eliminate things that help people. And that's what they're getting at. So, look, I pay my taxes every year. I pay them truthfully. I've never had a challenge, and I want to pay my fair share of taxes. But I'm amazed at sort of the mania that has developed over this. But I don't believe I don't know what he's referring to.
Okay. Jack in Pittsford. I think this is Jack. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
Hey, am I on?
Yes, go ahead, Jack.
Awesome. Yeah, I saw that Republicans were voting down a bill about veteran health care. And I was wondering what your thoughts on the bill were and if you had any insight into why it's kind of getting slowed up.
Yeah, Jack. Well, the good news, Jack, is that it's finally passed the United States Senate. It's something I worked on a long time with Senator Gillibrand, Senator Schumer. This essentially said that veterans who are exposed to burn pits and toxic substances have the presumption, if they develop a series of illnesses, the presumption is it was caused by their exposure. And we see, we did this similarly around Agent Orange and some other toxins that people were exposed to. So this does talk about the cynicism, though, in Washington. So we passed the bill in the Senate. We passed it in the House. It had to go back to the Senate for final passage because of a few modifications. And because Democrats reached a deal to address climate change, to bring down the cost of prescription drugs, reduce our deficit, and extend affordability for health insurance, because we did all those things, the Republicans got angry and withdrew their support of a bill to help veterans. It's disgraceful. It's the ultimate in cynicism. Even they ultimately had to back down, so they did finally pass the bill under protest, and the president has signed the bill, so that's the new law.
We've got a couple of questions from listeners about chips and a bill that passed there. I'll give you some time if you want to talk about that, but I'm also curious to know, given, frankly, the worldwide attention on Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan, Taiwanese manufacturing of chips and some of the leverage that comes with that. I've just got a number of questions there. I'll start with this. Do you think the speaker should have gone to Taiwan? Did you support that trip?
I think I would have preferred the speaker not go to Taiwan, because I feel if the State Department, the Department of Defense, and the White House are urging you not to do something, you should give a great deal of thought to it and be persuaded that that's the right thing to do. I understand, I guess, that many cheered the trip because it showed that we're not prepared to back down with China. But I, by the same token, I don't think we need to create more tensions that already exist in a world in which there are a lot of people whose nerves are being frayed. Taiwan is critically important to us, and making sure that their democracy is secure is a top priority for us. Making sure economically we're continue to engage with them is a vital national interest. But I don't think we need to look for reasons to antagonize. So my preference would have been for her to avoid going to Taiwan. But, everybody has to make their own judgments.
On the subject of chips, you want to take that one too?
Yeah, so the CHIPS and Science Act, which I had the privilege of leading the debate on the House floor, this is a multi-year effort. Both the Senate and the House had different versions, but fundamentally it does a number of basic things. One, it's going to invest dramatically in U.S. manufacture of semiconductors. Those chips are used in virtually everything. Try to get an automobile these days. The lack of chips in that industry has almost grind to a halt. The production of automobiles. General Motors said, I think just a week or so ago, they had 95,000 automobiles built, but not being able to be sold for want of semiconductor chips. So this is a huge move forward. I think the bill, all told, authorized about $280 billion. Some of it included appropriations to immediately start working with our private sector partners for the development of and production and manufacture of chips here in the United States. And this is incredibly important, not only because your cell phones and laptops and automobiles and virtually everything you use, refrigerators, microwave ovens, the list goes on and on, all have semiconductor chips in them. So economically, it's critically important. But secondly, it's important from a national security point of view, because our weaponry and our deterrence relies on access to microelectronics assemblies, of which semiconductor chips are a vital part. So this was really important. But the other things it does is it includes, for instance, regional innovation hubs, of which I think Rochester, New York will be first in class. 90% of our venture capital dollars in the United States goes to five primary areas around the country. So if you live in Austin, Texas, you live in Silicon Valley, you live in Boston or Seattle, Washington, you can find access to capital to grow businesses. But if you're in Rochester, New York, where we have extraordinary institutions like the University of Rochester, RIT. We have an amazing innovation ecosystem, but we're not able to attract dollars. So federal investment will go a long way towards continuing to accelerate the development of innovative products here in Rochester. And so I worked with the Chamber of Commerce. I worked with certainly the leadership at the University of Rochester and RIT and MCC. This is perhaps the most significant thing we've done in decades to advance science, to make sure that people who have been involved in these careers, people in communities of color, more women will get additional resources for workforce development. This is a huge step forward, and it's vital, and it really is the coming together of both economic security and national security interests.
On the subject of immigration, Ellen Smith sent us a note of Keeping Our Promise, a local organization that works with SIVs. And Ellen says, we have hundreds of refugees from Afghanistan in the Rochester community brought in through the evacuation of Afghanistan. We do not have enough attorneys to process their claims, and we need the Afghan Adjustment Act. Can you ask the congressman about this and where his support is on that? Congressman Morelli?
Yeah, I support it. I'll continue to support efforts to bring Afghanis to the United States, those who served with our veterans over there. We made a commitment to bring people here. Ellen and her organization are just wonderful. I can't say enough about the work that they're doing. We have John Polito in my office, engages with them regularly. I got a note from Nick Savanovich at the County Veterans Agency thanking us for our work to bring some of his Afghan families here recently. So we're happy about that. It is a long battle. And now because, you know, it's shifted really from the Department of Defense to the Department of State, we're working with our diplomatic corps to try to encourage people here. And we'll do whatever we can to bring these folks to the United States. They really did amazing work on our behalf. They and their families are very much in danger. So we're going to continue to work on that evacuation.
Tim says, Evan, ask the congressman to talk about making the region and the state more business friendly. Rochester has slipped to the fourth largest city in New York. People are continuing to move to Texas, Arizona, and Florida. We have become a tax exempt town with all the government buildings and nonprofits. That's shifting the burden to property owners who have stayed in the city. This isn't sustainable. Are we taking business development seriously?
Well, I know I take it seriously. I don't know that there's something that I focus more on. I think the CHIPS and Science Act is, again, something that I worked a long time on. I was on the conference committee to try to resolve differences between the House and Senate version. Every week I am at a number of businesses in all kinds of industries, not only high technology, but talking to businesses that are in the hospitality industry, elsewhere, to figure out how we can be successful. We can't grow as a region without job growth. And by the way, Rochester is actually leading the state in job growth. Our percentage of job growth leads every region, including New York City, and it has for a sustained number of quarters. So we're doing well. Those not-for-profits, University of Rochester, RIT, are really become the engine of growth for us because they're generating both the research and a world-class workforce to be able to work with these jobs. But I've been at, you just think of the technologies come OLED Works or Lifecycle in Eastman Business Park, or the work that's being done in the optics space. Corning's new investment in Rochester around diagnostic equipment for semiconductor industry, as well as tools to build semiconductor chips. I'm working with the Greater Rochester Enterprise on both the stamp facility just to the west, and other facilities that we're building. This is something we're on top of all the time. And Rochester, by the way, you know, much of this was highlighted in a book called Jumpstarting America. John Gruber and Simon Johnson, the two MIT economists who wrote about 130 communities across the United States that are poised for dramatic growth if we can get more investment from the federal government. Rochester, New York was number one on the list of 130 cities that they identified. We have an extraordinary ecosystem, but, you know, working with the Chamber, working with Greater Rochester Enterprise, working with ROC 2025, we are rebuilding this community. We have real challenges, there's no question, but a day doesn't go by that I'm not on the phones with folks at RIT and U of R and the Chamber and GRE just talking about what we can do to collaborate. And I work very closely with my New York State partners. So we're all collectively working and rowing in the same direction.
Lastly, the last week and a half has been a pretty extraordinary set of events, and you know, other journalists have chronicled every big event. I mean, there's a list of them. Even the killing of Ayman al-Zawahiri. There's been a passage of legislation. Gas prices are going down. There's this sense that, like, for the first time in months, Democrats might not feel as much despair. And I know Democrats routinely tell me that they guard against not feeling despair because that's their default mode. I'm mostly kidding. But in the last 40 seconds or so, I'm very curious to know, Congressman, do you feel like the last couple of weeks have shifted your own expectations for what is possible in November? And given it's a midterm election and the House always flips, is there a sense that that's inevitable, or is there a different idea about what could happen?
Well, first and foremost, I what I think about is Americans' despair and the things that, you know, families in this community are facing every single day in ways that we can impact them. I think Democrats have the proper message. I don't think we have a monopoly on all the answers, but I think we're moving in the right direction. I think our leadership has dramatically helped change where we are and the climate that we're in, and I think we're prepared for our best days ahead.
So you're an optimist. Okay.
I'm always an optimist. You can't be in this business, Evan, or you shouldn't be if you're not an optimist about where we can go.
I'm going to continue to try to convince your opponent in the upcoming election to join us here. I know that it's important to listeners to hear from all candidates. So Laurent Singletary knows, and his campaign knows, that's an open invitation. This conversation really was about the business of Washington, and we appreciate that with Congressman Joe Morelli. I hope we continue to talk about these issues soon, sir.
Great to be with you, Evan. Thanks so much.
That is Congressman Joe Morelli. And from the whole team at Connection, it's been a busy 2 hours today. Thanks for listening, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.